the most important part of, you know, I think the work that we do is how do you ensure that air pollution becomes everybody's problem, right? Air pollution is not a problem for the rich. It's not a problem for the poor. Unlike, you know, clean water where, you know, you can just purify the water that you're drinking through an RO machine that is installed in your house, you cannot purify the air that you're breathing every minute, every hour. You know, unless you were to contain yourself to a room that is, you know, connected up to the best in class air purifier. Air quality is the great leveler. That's the one thing that, you know, a poor person also needs as much as a rich person does.
So with that short brief from today's show, I welcome you to yet another episode of the Mission Junior podcast. I'm your host, Girish Shivakumar. And if this is the first time you're tuning in, I would highly encourage you to subscribe to the podcast. The podcast is now available on all major platforms for Android and Apple devices. According to the World Health Organization, air pollution accounts for over 7 million deaths annually. And in India, air pollution causes over 1 million deaths in a year. The reason I'm bringing this up is because air pollution peaks during the post-monsoon months in India, especially the national capital New Delhi, is in the global news, especially during this time of the year. So will this change this time around? Today's guest is someone who I have followed for a long time through his work in the power sector. In the last couple of years, he has spent significant time in researching the why, what, how of air pollution, especially in India and the national capital region of Delhi, where he is also based. The poor air quality in Delhi not only affects him, but also his young daughter. And hence, he is extra motivated to have a positive impact through his work in the space. So without further delay, join me in welcoming today's guest, Karthik Ganesan.
Hi, Girish. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
So for the listeners who are listening to you for the first time, can you give us a brief background?
So I'm currently a research fellow at the Council on Energy, Environment and Water, CEEW. We're a not-for-profit policy research organization based here in New Delhi. I've been with them for close to now almost, you know, 7.5 years. This is sort of the place where I've learned anything that I know about public policy. My research interests include, you know, power sector, air pollution increasingly, and also industrial activity in the country and understanding how we can make a transition to low carbon manufacturing.
That's a good start to give us a brief background of what you have done so far at CEEW. The reason but I got you on the podcast is to talk about your favorite topic in recent years, air pollution. So what's the background of this study, the research that you have undertaken in the last few years?
Well, you know, the air pollution work at CEEW itself, you know, is probably one of the younger ones. It's one of the younger streams of work that we do. But, you know, I'd say the first thing that we attempted to do really was when, you know, Delhi was called this gas chamber, you know, back in 2015, right? And by the Supreme Court, right? It's not the average person calling it. And, you know, and the Delhi government, as a quick response, you know, came up with this odd even scheme, you know, in January 2016. And we said, hey, let's try and understand, you know, what role does, you know, transport play? And that's when, you know, and back then data also was not as prominent as it is today. So we decided, you know, let's get hold of a few, you know, portable air pollution monitoring devices, low cost sensors, as we are called right now, and install them in a bunch of places where we feel that transport has a reasonably big role to play. And we did that, you know, and then we came out with this estimation that, okay, you know, actually there wasn't really much of an impact on air pollution itself. We also did traffic monitoring around that time in that study, and we found that traffic went down visibly. I mean, that was kind of obvious, but we just wanted to ensure that, you know, at least let's say the enforcement was reasonably good. Traffic went down, but air pollution not noticeably so. Other researchers will disagree, and they say that it actually has gone down, depends on what you're comparing it against. But in any case, the method that we use suggested that it hasn't gone down. But over the years, you know, air pollution is a problem that impacts every one of us. And, you know, as a researcher who was at that point in time focusing on power energy sector broadly, right, my continued survival in the city of Delhi depended on me understanding and being able to help solve this problem, because otherwise it becomes a hassle for you on a daily basis. So that's really how I think I got into the business of, you know, working on air pollution, you know, and slowly then we've built up a team as well. Now our work straddles, you know, not just, you know, Delhi's air pollution. I think we're interested in addressing air pollution pan-India in many parts of the country.
That's a good background and a good summary of what happened since 2015 when Delhi was really in the global news for its poor air quality. Why do you think Delhi tends to choke during October to December? I mean, people have different reasons. Diwali is obviously one of them. But what are your findings? Of course, Delhi, you would probably say that Delhi is usually choked throughout the year. But it tends to peak during October to December, right? And that's when it gets on the global media.
Correct. So, I mean, this is, you know, what, you know, as an informed researcher yourself, Girish, right, you know, your own perception is that, you know, Delhi, for example, chokes in October to December. And as you rightly say, you know, it's all relative, you know, Delhi barely has any good air quality days, right? So, the simple fact is we've normalized high levels of pollution in the city of Delhi, and in other parts of the country, people are not even aware of what they're breathing. So we've normalized whatever we're breathing, right? It doesn't matter. In Delhi, when the air quality AQI comes down to 150, we're all celebrating, right? And, you know, and we're like, oh, this is the day we've got to go out. So really, for much of the year, it's so bad that, you know, I'm not sure whether we should, you know, make October and December look particularly bad. But that said, the science does say that it is cumulative. So the worse it is, the more that you're breathing in of worse air. And as a result, it all adds up. So to that extent, yes, October to December does present a particularly bad challenge to the extent that, you know, it impacts, you know, it makes it sort of, even for people who are reasonably healthy, you might have acute incidence of, you know, air pollution related ailments. And now getting to the reasons of why it is the case. I mean, I think there are a few things, you know, that are, of course, you know, geography has a lot of role to play in this. Delhi being, you know, where it is situated in the country, landlocked, you know, no abating influences of a coast. There is what happens, you know, as the winter sort of progresses is this thing called temperature inversion happens, wherein, you know, a layer of warm air sits on top of, you know, colder layer of air at a reasonably, you know, high level in the atmosphere, within the troposphere, of course. And that then prevents the further movement and mixing of air pollution with the larger, you know, sort of, you know, air volumes that are present in the troposphere. As a result, everything kind of gets trapped in this, within this mixing height. Now, you can actually, if you're going in an aircraft, right, in the winters, right, and you just sort of, as you're landing in Delhi, you know, about to land rather, if you peer out, you will see that there'll be this gray, thick cloud, right, and then above that gray layer, it'll be like, you know, all blue and nice, right? You'll be like, hey, what are people talking about air pollution? So basically, everything below that is where, you know, the air pollution is completely trapped. So the temperature inversion and the low mixing height level plays a significant role. So meteorology plays a significant role in Delhi becoming what it does. But that said, you know, this is not unique to India, right? Many cold countries have this challenge, you know, and they fix it and they abate it, right? And they abate the anthropogenic sources. Now, in addition to this, you know, this temperature inversion, right, which is again a seasonal affair, Delhi also happens to be close to a, you know, like a desert, which means that, and also, you know, you don't have to be just next to it, but even if, you know, you're in the regional vicinity, right, you have sand and dust being carried all over from all the way from Central Asia, right? The deserts in Central Asia come through here, and of course the sand from the Rajasthan also makes its way here. So that adds kind of to the background levels of air pollution that you already have. So let's assume that even, you know, if we were to just stop all anthropogenic activity and emission, you will still find that there is some level of pollution, but a lot of that is PM10, right? A lot of the natural dust and the thing is PM10, PM2.5 is a smaller fraction in those, you know, in those sources. The big challenge really is particulate matter 2.5, PM2.5, which is finer than, or rather smaller than 2.5 microns, you know, which is many times thinner than the average, you know, strand of hair. And that, you know, can just, you know, nothing in your body, you know, in your physiology can help prevent that from getting deep into your lungs and getting embedded, right? Because, you know, your nasal hair and all of that stuff doesn't work against it, right? Or the only way that you can work that is air purifiers, you know, filters that you have, attached close to your nose, right? Or, you know, masks as they, you know, as a lot of people use them. And the other sources of PM2.5, the big sources of PM2.5 really are, you know, I guess there are a few, but I think to keep it simple, you have industrial emissions. You've got transport-related emissions. You've got waste burning, right? That's a significant component as well. And you've got,
correct,
thermal power plants, if you can look at them as a slightly different category, right? And you've got, road dust, as I said, but road dust is a much smaller source of, air pollution. It's PM2.5 itself, but nevertheless, it is important because PM10 also is a significant irritant. You will see that AQI, the concept of AQI that was defined, is actually sort of where, if any particular pollutant exceeds the threshold that is set for it, that will become the pollutant that determines what the AQI for that day is. So for, I would say, 95% of the days in Delhi, or maybe 90% of the days, PM2.5 is typically that threshold pollutant. Whereas on those really odd days, especially when Delhi is going through this high winds, right, the Loo, or maybe even in, just post the rainy season, even like recently, maybe last week, excessive winds that sort of really tends to, bring up a lot of, dust, right? There, PM10 might become the determining pollutant. So the AQI is determined or driven, so to say, by what the level of PM10 is and not necessarily PM2.5. So that was kind of like a long-winded answer to cover the concept of maybe what is PM2.5, PM10, and the sources for Delhi itself.
That's a pretty good answer as well. For anyone who's listening to that, probably will understand a lot more than what they can actually read from papers and get to know by themselves. And in fact, the other thing that you mentioned, like the thin layer of light that you can see when you're landing in close to Delhi, yeah, that strikes me quite openly as well whenever I land in Delhi, and I can clearly see that differential.
Mm-hmm.
Now, going back to your research, you briefly mentioned about the data points that you tracked for measuring Delhi's air quality. So what are your major findings from, say, Delhi's emission inventory? What did you find right and what was wrong?
So, I mean, I think this is less about, what is right or wrong. I mean, it's very strange, first of all, that in a country like India, there is no, accepted, emissions inventory, whether it's for the national level or for, subnational levels like, states and cities within states and or regions, within states, right? So, Indians, as it is, are very argumentative, as you know. And if you further add to the add to that by saying that there is no accepted number, then you'll have everybody coming up with their own, right? Of course, there are groups that are out there that do some really fantastic work that, that are very credible. I can take the example of urban emissions and a good collaborator of ours, Sharad Guttikonda, right? There's IIT Kanpur for instance. And even, only recently has, the Ministry of Earth Sciences actually gotten into it, right? There's this place called IITM, which is the Indian Institute of Tropical Meteorology, that is based out of Pune. They are also increasingly becoming a big player because they have now come up with an emissions and air quality forecasting system, right? Which Sharat, incidentally, has been running for almost, I think at least 2 years now, maybe longer. But nevertheless, the ministry has formally come in. Now, the reason I talk about these entities is, Delhi, of course, has been the favorite for a lot of agencies, right? CPCB, NIRI.
Exactly.
All of them. So because, one, of course, is the capital territory. So obviously, you want to manage air pollution and the media around it. But it's also because it's quite polluted, right? And it's where the monitoring is the most significant as well. And they've had inventories over the period of time. So there's been an inventorization exercise or a study that came out in 2010 from CPCB, but it captured inventory for 2007. Right, IIT Kanpur did a study as recently as 2016, but their inventory was for 2013-14. Terry did a study in 2018, that was for 2016. And of course, then you have Sharat and Safar, both of whom, Safar is the system that IIT Pune has put in, and that was for 2018. So by and large, we see that, all of them document and capture this diversity in, Delhi's emission sources, right? Which means that, they do all suggest that, it's not just a question of one single source. Many different sources have a role to play in terms of where, Delhi gets its air pollution from. But the challenge is that there is a broad variation, the range of variation, so to say, between them for various individual sources is quite significant. This is a problem. This is a problem because, among the premier researchers in the space, there is not entirely agreement about the extent to which each of them contribute. So, for example, right, Safar, for example, suggests that, has a very high, Safar and both Terry, for that matter, have a very high share of, PM2.5 coming from transportation, right?
Okay.
Whereas, for example, Sharat, right, has a significant share coming from industries, which you don't see in the Terry inventory. Safar kind of captures it, but to a lesser extent. Suffer exercise, for example, was done, you know, over a very short period of time, wherein they did not capture, emissions coming from other sources, right? So, for example, waste and biomass burning is not really part of the Suffer, inventory in a very clear manner. You know, whenever government of India, you know, does not have the ability to classify something, they'll call it other. Right now, other can be anything True. Under the sky, right? Whereas, as researchers, you know, we are always like, I want to ensure that other and all that is as minimal as possible. Let's try and attribute everything Correct. To some source or the other. So I think there is there is consistency in that among them in saying that, okay, it's a multi-pronged problem. There are multiple sources. It's not, there's no silver bullet. That's what, you can conclude by looking at all of them. But what you can't quite say is, what is the extent of the problem? And I'll sort of end this part with one statement, which is that we have talked about only emissions inventory. And that's what we largely focused on. As emissions inventory is the starting point to any assessment of what the ambient pollution itself is coming from. Because, you could have, depending on, so for example, if you look at a particular domain, right, or an area which you're trying to study, if a lot of the emission sources are, let's say, industrial sources which have a very high stack and they emit at a certain height, right? A lot of that will go away, right? It's not going to remain local. Whereas sources that are, that are closer to the ground, which get emitted there, will probably tend to linger and at the end of the day are more important from a perspective of understanding what your exposure is towards. So so effectively, inventory is one part of it. But then when you add inventory and then you add the meteorology to it, right? At what height is this thing emitted? You will find that the resultant, source apportionment and what source is contributing to the air pollution in Delhi is a slightly different thing altogether, right? The study that we did, of course, focused entirely, I would say, on emissions inventory for Delhi. But it's a good starting point because you at least know what are the sources of pollution that exist within Delhi. But then the fact is, what is actually polluting Delhi is stuff that was generated within its boundary and things that were generated outside but got carried in.
Correct.
That got carried in. So I guess you understand the subtle difference between, source contribution or source apportionment and inventory share.
True.
So it's sort of like a fine line, but it's important to understand that not everything that's currently in our air is really from Delhi itself. And that actually is the crux of the matter in that in winters, what's happening? Right, especially now, if you look at October, Diwali is not for another 20 days or rather 15 days, right? But nevertheless, you will find that the air quality in the next 2 days is already going to go into the poor category, right? It's one part of it is
very
because
bad.
They're very poor category, actually. One part of it is because at this point in time, for the next 3 to 4 weeks, the narrative is going to be dominated by what farmers in Punjab are doing vis-a-vis the crop residue that remains after they've harvested their rice crop, paddy crop. And what they do, and this has also been extensively discussed in many publications, we've also worked on that, is that it's very difficult to sort of get the field prepared for the next sowing season, which has to be done before the middle of November. And the quickest way of clearing residue remaining from rice harvest, right, is basically by setting the field on fire. That will take care of the stubble that remains, and it will also take care of the the crop residue that was cut and put away by the combine harvester. So the fastest way to clear for them, and in some sense the cheapest way as well, is that. And as a result, and there's going to be significant pollutant load coming into Delhi from a few hundred kilometers away in Punjab, in across all districts of Punjab, across many districts of Haryana, and also western Uttar Pradesh, because this is when rice gets harvested, and rice was, as sown in the just pre-monsoon, and it grows through the monsoon period, and then it's ready for harvest at the end of the monsoon period, and that's now.
As you would have heard Karthik describe the various facets of air pollution and the sources for air pollution in Delhi, you would appreciate the fact that it is tough for mitigating air pollution unless we have the right data to act. So here is the part of the conversation where we discuss the challenges in measurement and what the Indian government is doing for it.
I mean, these are really valid points. I totally understand your point on the data uncertainty and the difficulty in classifying what's the inventory and what's the source. Just before we go to the mitigation measures and what's the impact of that, one quick question on the data uncertainty. So Has the government done anything to ensure that the data is collected and measured in a proper structured way? Since in the last 3 to 4 years, the awareness is increased. But what has the government done to ensure we can actually track data and monitor them? I'm sure like CEW has done a lot of work in monitoring this, but what is the support from the government?
So as you rightly mentioned, air pollution has taken on sort of like a political color in the last, I would say a year, right? I think even after the NCAP got announced, I think now, you know, there is some, you know, legal mandate to go after, you know, the political class to say, you know what, you're responsible for this and all that. So to that extent, I think in the last year or so, I would say there's more, you know, uptake of, you know, active interventions in pollution mitigation, as opposed to sort of reactive, which is what is happening in Delhi, I would say, you know, between 2014 and 2018, right? It was really about short-term plans, you know, graded response action plan, you know, when the things get, you know, really bad, then what do we do then? Now, to your question on, you know, what can government do, especially on the monitoring front? So, as I mentioned to you, the inventories that were there, right? So, SAFAR and IIT Kanpur are the only sort of, you could call it government-driven studies, right? And IIT Kanpur, at the end of the day, is an autonomous research institution, while they get a lot of support from government. But, you know, there's an independent piece of research. They published, a significant paper, right, or at least a full-fledged report that gives a lot of details around how they did what they did. Whereas if you go look at the SAFAR inventory exercise, and for that matter, even their, you know, their forecasting system, right, it's very unclear, you know, what their underlying sort of conditions are. What is the inventory arising from various sources? Right, they're giving you a forecast. True. I mean, and they talk about collaboration with, you know, with agencies like NCAR in the USA and multiple research organizations. You know, I think they also have a Finnish collaboration. But at the end of the day, it's very unclear what their emissions inventory actually is. And I think the most important thing is this: all said and done, while there might be private actors like, you know, Sharath or Terry for that matter, right, who are also trying to kind of create their own inventory, the reach of the government when it comes to being able to, you know, collect data on various sources of pollution is unparalleled, right? Correct. They have an eye and so to say, you know, regulatory control over so many sectors and so many emitters, right? Imagine if they came together with the capacity that private sector provides for analysis and for, you know, insights, right, to actually create like a concrete inventory database, right, that can then be commonly used by all researchers, right, who are interested in forecasting, who are interested in addressing, you know, whatever nuance that they want to go after, right? There are some groups that will say, I want to go after aerosols. Some groups will say, I want to go after ozone, after free radicals, you know, whatnot. Correct. All of that stuff can happen, but let's all get consensus on who's emitting. Now, today, hegemony is defined by who has access to data, which is a very sad state of affairs because, you know, that's not where the real meat is. The real meat lies in your ability to convert that data into real good insights. And for that, capacity exists with multiple people, you know, but if that data is not made available, and unfortunately, the sad truth is, at least when it comes to emissions inventory, there is no real data that's available in the public domain at the levels at which it is needed, right? People like, you know, Sharath, for example, for whom it's his, you know, I would say day is bread and butter, shares some sort of, you know, insights. But then again, the moment, you know, you open up your inventory in full for, you know, for all kind of dissection, then you have to answer tons of questions around, oh, why did you assume that? Because at the end of the day, inventory is really about a lot of assumptions as well. You cannot know with certainty, right, how many cars plied on the road on a particular day and how many liters of fuel did they guzzle, right? They're all based on some assumptions around, you know, typical, you know, vehicle usage, you know, typical, you know, efficiency, right, maintenance practices, all of that. Now, the moment when you put up an inventory, which, you know, is done by one group, right? Yes, of course, some of them are in peer-reviewed literature, but nobody's really gone and dissected, you know, each and every aspect of the inventory. Which is why, you know, I think it's important for a lot of groups to come together and possibly government being the agency that's kind of driving this collaboration to come up with this, you know, unbiased and, you know, and sort of, you know, universally acknowledged inventory. Now, the one thing that the government does have currently under its control are these monitoring stations. Right, there are about 37 or 38 in Delhi, and which is the highest. You know, I mean, Delhi has almost, I think, 38 out of the 200 that are currently there in the country. So, given that that data from all of those monitors is something that is very crucial, because that data is really what allows you to then go, you know, look at, okay, what is your modeled concentration across Delhi? Because typically these models can give you, you know, concentration at a relatively good resolution, depending on how your model is set up. And then, you know, you can choose to say, okay, this particular monitor that is here, you know, is in this area. And if I average my model concentration across, you know, some sort of like a boundary around this particular monitor, I could say that, oh, is my value matching with this particular monitor? So it'd be very good to have that monitor data as a way of checking whether your model is, first of all, you know, reasonably estimating emissions at a particular point or over a small region reasonably accurately. Now, this data itself, for example, CPCB and DPCC do not make available in the most granular level as possible. The data is available every 15 minutes from many of these CAA QMS, continuous air quality monitoring stations. But what is made available publicly is a 24-hour average. There's a world of difference between a 15-minute data and 24-hour average data. 24-hour average is good enough for, you know, policy decision-making, all of that. But when you want to combine it with, because meteorology changes in the, you know, at the drop of a hat, and you want to be able to capture whether your model has been set up well enough to capture this variation, right? Activity changes over the course of the day. To do all those checks, you need that data. Now, that data should be made available public. It is collected using public money, and there's no reason why it should not be. If anything, the reason why it's not being made available is because, you know, they have to then answer and respond to a whole bunch of questions. If people start, you know, looking at that data with a fine-tooth comb, you will find that there are many issues with some of these monitoring stations because they never ever get maintained properly.
Correct.
There are issues of calibration in some of these devices. So, you know, to sort of, I think, make it easier for everybody, for at least, you know, for the people, the regulators, this data is not being made available. And I think this needs to happen. We've increasingly felt that, you know, I think CPCB and, you know, Ministry of MOEFCC have, you know, become warmer, you know, and have started, you know, sort of realizing that this data is important to be made available. And I think the effort is underway. But, you know, it's a fairly easy task if you set your mind to it. And I think that is something that needs to happen from government, because private sector cannot replace the government when it comes to the level of monitoring that can actually be put.
Correct.
Each of these devices costs anywhere between, you know, I guess 1.5 to 2 crores. Maybe it's lesser now. I mean, I'm quoting from my memory again. But that said, somebody, you know, has computed saying that, you know, India requires about 4,000 of these.
Yeah.
To really cover the, you know, the geography entirely, right? We have 200. Now, is it possible for the private sector to put in that kind of money? No. Now, it also seems like, you know, the government doesn't have the money. I mean, one can argue, you know, different ways. You know, the cost that you incur in this is nothing compared to the benefit that will reveal. But all of that benefit will come only when you share that data publicly and allow people to make decisions based on that. If that is not public, then there's very little that is actually happening. Right. So that, I think, is kind of where the situation is when it comes to what the role of government in this is. Yeah,
that's a good picture about where we stand in terms of data. For I'm sure like most of the listeners who are listening to this argument will probably agree, because what can't be monitored and measured can never be acted upon. So monitoring and measuring of data is like
correct,
very crucial, especially in this field. On talking of data, I had a recent experience where someone told me that government is very open with data these days, especially, and this person was from the auto sector. So he told me government is willing to share data about all the vehicles registered and what is their age and every data, but they're asking a premium for it. So that's the other side of things. I'm sure like government will want to give data, but they also look at it as a way of making money. So hopefully that's not the case in when they give the data from air quality stations. So before I get into the National Clean Air Program, I'm sure like most of them, people, especially people outside of India, would probably be very keen to hear this. Are the recent mitigation measures really helped curb the pollution impacts in Delhi?
Right. So, I mean, it's too hard. It's too early to tell, right? It's too early to tell, primarily because, you know, the National Clean Air Plan itself, you know, was put in place on the 10th of January, or it was announced on the 10th of January. So we're within the first year. And if you look at the range of things that were described in the national, you know, in the National Clean Air Plan, one could argue that many of those things actually haven't happened, right? And in you know, 9 months is too short a duration to expect that change to happen. In any case, it is intended to reduce by 20-30% over a 5-year period, right? 2024 is when they will sort of really go and do a stock take, you know, at the end of 2024, or you know, whenever. So I would not comment on, you know, whether things have worked. But that said, you know, it's very, very important to remember this. unless we have a completely good handle on what's polluting Delhi's air, right? As I said, there are lots of studies, there are a lot of people who do, you know, excellent, you know, forecasting, but even these researchers acknowledge that far more is needed if you want to sort of really look at actionable, you know, items. But it'll be very difficult for us to say whether overall air quality actually is improved, because one, you just did not measure enough, you know, 3-4 years ago. The non-attainment cities were actually made on the basis of their emissions, or sorry, their ambient air quality between the years 2011 and 2015. Until 2015, Delhi had only less than 10 monitors.
Wow.
Less than 10. So, I mean, probably even 6 or 7, right? And you can imagine where the number of monitors was pan-India. So, I'm talking about the continuous air quality monitors. But that's it. There are these manual monitoring stations that, you know, that the CPCB runs and the, you know, the pollution control boards run across the country. And a manual monitoring station is really where you get 24-hour averages, right? You don't get anything real-time. You basically have a device where, you know, which is kind of got like a filter or whatever, you know, and then it's capturing, you know, it's continuously sort of taking in air and, you know, dumping it into the filter. And the filter kind of really then is, you know, when you analyze the filter, you understand, okay, how much, you know, of air pollution did I actually measure that day, right? Of different kinds. And you can do a whole range of things with the air pollution that's been captured, so to say, physically on that filter. And then somebody analyzes it, you know, and then the filter gets replaced for the next 24 hours. Right? This is a manual monitoring station. Now, this is what we really, the entire National Clean Air Program, right, is based on the National Monitoring Program, which relies on, manual monitors. Not on continuous monitors that give you data of a much higher fidelity. So that said, as a result of that, really, you know, and given that the number of monitors in Delhi has really gone up over time, what we found, right, contrary to claims, is that air quality is possibly worsened in the last 3 to 4 years. This is what happens when you end up having, I would say, when neither part, so one party which has, you know, access to really good quality data is not willing to sort of really make it public. And the other party, which is basically researchers in, you know, on this side of the fence, right, who are trying to sort of really work with anything that they have right now, when you put together the pieces, you're not able to sort of back the claim that, let's say, Delhi government is currently coming out with, right? Full page ads have been taken out in the last few weeks, right? The most recently being last week in the Indian Express, of, you know, how Delhi's air pollution is reduced by 25%, right, over the last 3 years. Right now, clearly, of course, I'm really glad that, you know, both the center and the state government are, you know, fighting with each other to take credit for this decrease. But whether or not this decrease happened is the much bigger question at stake here, right? And that you can only establish unequivocally, right? If you have clear data that is consistent, where you know that, you know, if you, for example, if I were to track, has it improved consistently in every location across Delhi? Because, you know, you've got these new monitors coming up all across, spread across different parts of the city, right? You have got different quality of data coming out from each of them. Some of these monitors did not have data for 70% of the days in many early years. The data availability has become 80% only now. But earlier, you know, given the, nascent stage of the installations and all of that, half these monitors were not giving you data for long, you know, for more than, 20-30% of the time. So you really are, you know, kind of, you know, stitching together, you know, very tenuous arguments, right, to say, oh, air quality is improved. You're in some sense cherry picking.
True.
You know, maybe, if you say cherry picking, that may be sort of too much of a casting aspersions at their intention, which is not the case. I'm not suggesting that they're intentionally, masking data. But if you sort of just pick data that you have without understanding what the quality is, then you will end up with findings that are counterintuitive. And that's really what we're seeing here. I mean, this is not to say that, you know, there have not been active efforts, but we just feel that given the data that is currently available out there, you cannot say clearly that air quality has actually improved, right? If anything, you've had more number of cars, you know, you've got most of the activity that happens within Delhi has only gone up in scale. Yes, since 2014, after the deregulation of diesel, we know that the share of diesel cars in the sale has decreased. Right, but that's it. The number of diesel cars has only gone up. The share of diesel cars in the sale has gone down.
True.
The number of diesel cars in Delhi has only gone up. So, and emissions ultimately is cumulative. Right, it is not about, you know, we're not talking about relative rise in air pollution between X year and Y year. We're talking about absolute increase in air pollution. And I certainly feel, as a resident of Delhi, I don't see any positive sign in terms of, you know, air pollution actually having changed. And I think a simple example to illustrate is this, right? Maybe the crop burning example, I think, is appropriate.
Hmm.
2016 saw the, you know, the highest burning rates in recent times.
Correct.
Right? Because there was a massive shift towards, you know, rice after the, you know, the cotton crop in 2015 failed. A lot of the farmers were, you know, left in the lurch, and they said, you know what, let me just go towards something which is safe, right? And they went to rice. And as a result, you know, that basically meant there was a lot more crops ready to be burnt. And 2016 was terrible.
True.
And after that, you know, the numbers have been coming down. Now, if somebody takes credit for the farmer's decision to not actually cultivate rice, right, that's very perverse, right? So effectively, while the numbers will say that 2017 and 18 showed a significant decline compared to 2016, right? But that the reason for that is not because, you know, you're suddenly your monitoring and your enforcement of the burning ban actually happened. It's because farmers chose not to cultivate as much rice. And between 2017 and 18, when there was 1,000 crore that was made available, there was absolutely no change in the amount of burning, at least as seen from the satellites, right?
Nice.
So which means that all we are also, of course, measuring change at, you know, too fast. I mean, 1 year is far too little. And I'm not suggesting that we have to wait for 5 years to measure. Let's measure periodically. But let's not expect change to happen, you know, in a year or, you know, 18 months time. Right? Some of these things are very, very sticky, right? Our travel patterns, you know, as people who, you know, we are all contributing to air pollution.
Correct.
We all use, you know, cars, Uber or Ola, or whatever, right? We don't suddenly overnight become people, you know, who just espouse public transport and do it for private transport altogether, right? So unless and until we ourselves can't do some of these changes overnight, we also can't expect the air quality to change overnight. There are lots of things that can happen overnight wherein, you know, you shut out the most egregious of polluters, right? You know, the worst offending industries and the, you know, the vehicles that are 15 years old. But those are all like, you know, one fringe in the problem.
Correct.
They're not really the bulk of the problem.
That's a very valid argument. I mean, especially with the current state where the data clarity is not available. And there is, I mean, of course, the reason like you mentioned about the farmer's choice to switch to rice in a particular year. And you can't take that as a base year to measure decrease in pollution. Now, we will get to the other parts. You briefly mentioned about the National Clean Air Program. So where do you see the National Clean Air Program taking the, or rather improving the air quality in other Indian cities? I mean, Delhi is just one part of the big puzzle. Every other Indian city will probably also complain that our air quality is equally bad. So where do you see the National Clean Air Program addressing all this?
I mean, I think the National Clean Air Plan, for all its flaws, is one of the better things to happen, you know, for Indian cities as a whole, right? Delhi was anyway under the scanner. But the National Clean Air Plan really brought in focus 102 more cities. And, you know, in August, I think the NGT has actually asked for the non-attainment cities list to be increased by a further 20. So a total of 122 cities would have come under the, you know, ambit of the National Clean Air Plan. What it has mandated is for all these cities to go back to the drawing board and come up with, you know, clean air plans for their cities, right? Mm. The city administration or the state administration. It has asked, you know, multiple agencies to basically come together to build, you know, reliable information regarding what is actually polluting these cities, right? How do you come up with, you know, solutions that are appropriate to the city's problems? Now, that's the intention. But then again, you know, you announced this on the 1st of, you know, on the 10th of January, and by, I think, sometime in October or something was when the deadline was, or maybe even August. To submit, you know, your clean air plans, right? The last update I remember, I think about 45, 50 of them have actually submitted. Cities like Bangalore, their plan was actually rejected. They were so bad, right, that they were actually rejected in the first go. It had to actually resubmit it, right? And you also notice that many of these cities, right, when they come up with clean air plans, especially, you know, there are, you know, Maharashtra has 17 non-attainment cities. UP, I think, has 15. You will find that, you know, effectively, you know, it's the state pollution control board in the in that state that's kind of coordinating this effort, or maybe the Department of Environment, depending on, you know, who the nodal officer is. You will find that some of them are, you know, sort of replicas of each other, you know, these plans, right? Because at the end of the day, each state has its own problems. Each city, so to say, has its own problem. It is very unlikely that, you know, city A and city B will have the exact same contribution from the exact same source. Of course, by and large, you know, you have only 4 or 5 key sources. So I'm not suggesting that you have to come up with a different source of air pollution. But to what extent is that the problem? Surely will be different across many different cities because they're all in, you know, different catchment areas, right? So if you go to a certain industrialized part of the state and cities close to that will certainly feel the brunt of the, you know, from the emissions from the industries. But do you even have a sense of how much those industries are emitting? Have you been using the SEMS data from those industries to actually monitor and track what could be the impact and the total pollutant load? So you haven't done all of that over so many years, right? And you know, again, just like, you know, pollution data from, you know, continuous air quality monitoring stations, SEMS data from industries is another, you know, Pandora's box. It is not, you know, even though the CPCB has endorsed it, you know, many people feel that, you know, these devices are wrongly calibrated, you know, they don't give you the right readings, you know, this is not something that I can go by. So as a result, we've never explored those data sources. So what's now happening is cities have to go and look at all of this different data that's available to them. Does a city even know how much waste is generated within its periphery? Only when you know how much waste is generated and then you actually tabulate that against the waste that is going to your landfills, which hopefully is sort of, you know, controlled and regulated, you will know how much waste remains unpicked.
True.
When you know how much waste remains unpicked, you know that that is potentially getting taken care of by burning. Because at the end of the day, waste has to be, you know, disappear Correct. From the streets, right? It's somebody's job, right? So either it's the RWA will do it, or maybe the, you know, the person who's doing the cleaning up, you know, he'll like say, okay, I can't take it anywhere. Nobody's picking it up from here. I'll set it afire. So you, for you to get a sense of how much is coming from waste burning, you have to know how much waste you're generating, how much are you actually collecting, right? And how much potentially remains on the ground.
True.
Similarly, when it comes to, you know, transport-related ones, I mean, how many cities have the wherewithal to carry out an exercise to understand traffic, you know, and vehicular movement? I mean, it requires the collaboration with suitable agencies. So 102 cities, or for that matter, 122 cities, right, being asked to come up with these kinds of plans in 9 months' time, where the number of technical agencies that can potentially work with them are limited and finite, is unrealistic. So one would basically expect half-baked plans. But that's it. Even a half-baked plan at this point will suffice, so long as we can go after the clear, you know, sort of, you know, polluters and within, you know, within the boundary of a particular city, or even, you know, ones who are just outside the boundary of the city itself. And that requires a second-order thing, which is about the capacity of the pollution control boards, right? And the relevant agencies. I mean, again, not everything falls in the pollution control board, because they are largely responsible only for industries. They're not responsible for, you know, vehicular pollution, because that's not what they were set up for.
True.
The Department of Transport needs to ensure that, you know, people who ply their vehicles on the road get this POC thing done, and those who don't get, you know, fined by police and take appropriate action. When it comes to waste-related stuff, it's the municipality. It is not the pollution control board. So better or worse, everything has fallen on the pollution control board when it comes to, you know, having to check this. But at the end of the day, they've got to pull together all these, you know, relevant departments and say, you know what, okay, where are we at? Do you know how much you're contributing? All of that takes time, right? That cannot happen, you know, overnight, or even over nine months. Is, I think progress can be made, right? But again, I don't think, you know, there's that much progress done, because we work with some state, you know, and I think a lot of them are showing earnest interest now, because air pollution is truly something that has now become part of the dinner table conversations, right? Thanks again to a lot of the stuff that's happened in Delhi, and also to a lot of those groups and people who've gone out there and taken the message that air quality can significantly deteriorate your health, poor air quality. And I think the Ujjwala program that the government ran is the best example of it. And I think it was a great example where they showcased the improvements for women's health and women and child health in rural households by simply shifting from, you know, polluting solid fuels to LPG-based cooking. I mean, and I think that definitely has spurred some interest in understanding what exactly is air pollution. And, you know, this is something that we have to acknowledge, that this is one thing that we got right. And as a result, there's hopefully some spillover effect where people start taking air pollution from all the other sources more seriously.
So, Karthik, we had a detailed discussion on what's currently lagging in the system and what is the plan by the government, the National Clean Air Plan. So as a research organization, what are your plans in taking the research forward? Your study in Delhi is, of course, a very intense study where you compared a lot of other data points, other studies that have been in this place. When you go, I'm sure you want to take your study to a national level. So what are your plans in the air pollution space?
I mean, a lot of our work, so being an institution that's based in New Delhi and being in a city where, you know, the air quality issues have not yet been resolved, clearly, you know, our interests are in ensuring that our immediate environment, you know, gets clean. So we started with Delhi, you know, we started looking at, you know, in data inconsistencies, because Delhi is also the place where you have a lot of data to work with. But when you go step outside of Delhi, right, I mean, when you find that, you know, there are 120 other cities, you know, which in the non-attainment list, and you've got rural areas, right? There are, you know, close to 650 districts in the country. I mean, and all of them have, you know, terribly poor air. But unfortunately, there's no information or data regarding how bad things are there. So given that, you know, there is this data challenge outside, and I think what we need to do is, you know, address this slightly differently. I think what we should not be doing, one, of course, as, you know, as one, on our own, and of course, I think is a view that's shared by many of my, you know, collaborators and colleagues in this space, is that it's not really data for data's sake where we want to sort of, you know, make cities look, you know, bad, right? It's not to show that, hey, you're doing so badly. And I think just by, you know, looking at the air in many places, you know, especially during winters, you'll have a sense, you know, and looking at the, the quality of life that people experience, right? The colds and the coughs that come in, you know, seasonally, right? Notwithstanding flu season, all of that are, of course, you know, related to air pollution. So there is already clear awareness. So it's not really about, you know, getting that number accurate and, you know, going after cities that don't have good air quality. It's really about ensuring that they take this data and do something. And I think there are two things that need to be done here. One is, first of all, we need to help these agencies identify what are these blind spots that they're currently missing when it comes to, you know, various emission sources. And that is something that requires a detailed mapping of where, you know, what is the kind of emission sources that we have for various regions of the country, right? Yes, we know the biggest, you know, power plants, we know the biggest, you know, steel plants and the aluminium smelters and perhaps the refineries, but do we know where all the brick kilns are? Because brick kilns contribute a lot to deteriorating air quality, primarily because they are in the lakhs, or maybe in the tens of thousands. I mean, I might be exaggerating that they're in the lakhs, but I think they are actually. You know, if you travel the landscape from, you know, anywhere, Delhi, you just step out of Delhi and you go towards, you know, any one of the, you know, UP cities, you will find that the brick kiln is the most ubiquitous thing in the landscape that you'll see there. Absolutely unregulated, right? And the need for bricks, given that, you know, housing is something that, you know, pretty much every Indian is always involved in, right? Some expansion plan, somebody building a new thing. There is always a demand for bricks, right? It's possible that large urban centers are going everywhere, but small construction is still dependent on these, you know, crudely made bricks, right? Which have no, you know, quality testing or any of that stuff. So sources like this, I mean, I'm just taking on the example of brick kilns just to highlight the point that there are many sources that cities aren't even aware of. Right. After, you know, various agencies got involved, you know, Bihar, for instance, has taken a serious, you know, cognizance of the role of brick kilns in deteriorating air quality for cities like Patna, Muzaffarpur and Gaya. I can't say the same for, you know, let's say a large state like Uttar Pradesh, right, where there is, you know, a massive effort that's underway. IIT Kanpur is based there. There are some phenomenal, you know, academics who are working in these institutes that understand air quality. But, you know, I can see, you know, as a person who travels frequently to Lucknow, you know, and who's seen sort of the vicinity of it, there is no regulation on what these brick kilns can do. So we need to ensure that we're able to identify and have a mechanism by way of which you can actually act on these blind spots. The second thing is monitoring, and, you know, monitoring in by and large and in general. I think, you know, while, as I said, 4,000 monitors may be required to, you know, fill the data gap that exists in the sector, right? For the country as a whole, we know that getting 4,000 devices, while, you know, we can easily afford it as a country, right? 4,000 crores, 5,000 crores, easily done. Not a problem, right? Yeah, you know, that's massive. It's massive, but we have a big budget, and health should be an important part of it. Even if we can get there, can we really ensure that all of this data will sort of be used in a streamlined manner? And is that the best sort of way in which we can actually narrow down on the problems of air quality for our various cities? One could argue that there are other ways of doing it, right? You have, you know, for example, low-cost monitors, for example, that are there in a big way that can be used. You know, they can be certified, they can be, you know, calibrated against, you know, reference monitors, and sort of they can be fit for purpose to identify what are the areas where things are really bad. You know, it's not understand, you know, if you're really going down to the first decimal, or even, for instance, you know, whether you're wondering whether the air quality of PM2.5 is 90 or 97, really, that's not the question. How do we bring it down to 50 is the question. So if a low cost monitor tells you 97 or 100, whereas a reference monitor tells you 90, both of them are ballpark telling you that you're in a bad zone, that you need to get much lower. And for that purpose, I think we can certainly use it. There are, you know, satellites offer a phenomenal opportunity for us to be able to track many different kinds of air pollution from, you know, the eye in the sky. We don't need to have monitors on the ground. But all said, all of these things combine well with good modeling techniques. Right? There are far too, you know, few groups in India, right, for a country the size that we have, right, to say that, you know, we're able to sort of, you know, help various, you know, local areas understand what the air quality for them is. One group sitting out of Goa, I'm referring to Sharath's, right, cannot cater to the needs of the country. We need many such groups coming out, you know, that actually talk about what the missing data challenges are, make what is available right now, you know, open so that such groups can take them up. And more importantly, how do you cultivate more such groups, at least when it comes to the research and helping out, you know, our technical bodies like the pollution control boards. Pollution control boards haven't recruited, you know, in many of them, right, have not recruited in 1 or 2 decades. There are many challenges associated with it. When you don't have an agency that's kind of, you know, up to pace with the newest developments, right, where the manpower is not necessarily able to tackle some of the upcoming challenges, and where the purpose of the agency is not to control, you know, ambient air quality, but to control industrial pollution, you have a problem. So essentially, we also need to pay equal attention to how do we ensure that these agencies are also supported, right, by the best available information that is there. Right. And I think that is something that we want to try and do for, you know, for as many states that, you know, we can, given the limited size and resources that we have at our disposal. And finally, I think the most important part of, you know, I think the work that we do is how do you ensure that air pollution becomes everybody's problem? Right. Air pollution is not a problem for the rich. It's not a problem for the poor. Unlike, you know, clean water, where, you know, you can just purify the water that you're drinking through an RO machine that is installed in your house. You cannot purify the air that you're breathing every minute, every hour, you know, unless you were to contain yourself to a room that is, you know, connected up to the best in class air purifier. Air quality is the great leveler. That's the one thing that, you know, a poor person also needs as much as a rich person does. And a rich person can't really do too much to ensure that, you know, he's completely protected from it. You spend 16 hours a day outside your home. So given that, we need to ensure that the poor person and the rich person are both equally aware of what the impacts of this are. And at the end of the day, they need to understand that each one of them is a cause for the poor air quality that is around us. If the poor person is responsible for burning waste to keep themselves warm in the winters of Delhi, the rich person is equally responsible by taking out his SUV, you know, for the shortest of trips. The rich person who is engaged in the industrial activity, who probably is the owner of an industry, needs to realize that, you know, air quality from at his home is very much dependent on what he is doing in his industrial unit. And in equal measure, the, you know, the guy who is, you know, the running the service center, you know, that works with, you know, used oil filters, needs to realize that the energy that is soaked up in the oil filter, while it might be useful for him in his shop, if he burns that, the amount of, you know, carcinogens and pollution that it releases is harmful, not just for his health, but, you know, for the health of so many hundreds and thousands of people. So every one of us needs to ensure that, you know, we are doing the right things when it comes to the little bit that we are responsible in our own way for making the air around us bad. And I think we all need to sort of come together to sort of espouse the solutions that are available, right? Public transport is one of them. Simple things like, for example, providing, you know, at least in the city like Delhi, right? Winters, one will ask, okay, crop burning is done, Deepavali is done. So what is now causing it? Well, you have tens of, you know, thousands of homeless people. You have thousands of security guards who spend the night outside. Do we have a solution for keeping them warm except for having to burn whatever they can get their hands on? Unless we can work on that, it's what they're going to burn is what you'll be breathing 10 seconds later, right? And I think this is where we have to make this everybody's problem, right? Where everybody needs to be feel empowered that, you know, they can do something about it. It's not that, you know, oh, this is a thing that has been created by a massive industry. We don't have any rights. No, you have to be aware of what those rights are, what the recourse that you have is, complain at the appropriate agencies, right? Find out what your way is to get the right data that is needed to make your case. And there are many groups across the country that do it. One that comes to mind, for example, is one that we work with is this Hinjewadi Industrial IT Resident Welfare Association, HIRWA, right? They're based out on the outskirts of Pune, very, very, you know, sort of, you know, vibrant community, you know, of, you know, young professionals in the in the IT space, you know, many of them are returns from overseas and all of that. And not to suggest that this is a rich person's problem, but well, they've realized that in the area that they live in, waste burning is a massive problem, right? And Pune as a city, which is by and large, you know, one of the cleaner ones, right, has an enclave which is, you know, pretty, you know, as an upmarket enclave which faces a poor air quality, you know for sure that they're going to throw up their arms and say this is not permissible. And they've done that, right? They sought inputs from, you know, these whatever little low-cost monitors were available. They accosted, you know, government officials to say, hey, the air quality here is bad. And I see that every time the burning starts there, it starts, you know, deteriorating the air that I'm breathing. And they have now come together, you know, they have, you know, education campaigns in schools, you know, and trying limiting, you know, activities so that people realize that air quality is really deteriorating, right, and detrimental to their health. Right. So all of these things are great, you know, things to happen, you know, when it comes to increasing the awareness around, you know, the impacts of air pollution. And I think finally, you know, you need to sort of give people the belief that, you know, the change lies in the way they do things. And if cities like Delhi can do that, you know, I think, you know, one can disagree with, you know, the move to make public transport free. I'm not exactly a proponent of it either. But if that is really the barrier in, you know, a lot of people using public transport, you know, let's at least try and see whether, you know, we can actually get them to use public transport. Can we increase the number of buses in Delhi? If the demand for, you know, free public transport goes up, right, is that, will that be incentive to increase the supply of public transport that will then allow for others also to come on board? I think these are the kinds of questions that I think we should really be targeting, you know, and I hope that, you know, we make this, you know, as much an election issue as we do, you know, our water supply, or for that matter, you know, the monetary, you know, the job crisis, or the economic slowdown, whatever it might be, or national security, right? Let's put physical personal security over national security and say that I want clean air before we go ahead and make, you know, national security the reason for, you know, for me to vote or not vote.
No, that's very well summarized, Karthik. As a research firm, you're looking at the bigger picture. You're not just looking at, I need this data points to prove some point, but you're having a broader purpose and you want to get a message across. That's a very good thought and a very good approach to work towards a problem. You just don't want to stop at research. You want to see actionable action happening on ground. And as you rightly said, it couldn't have been better said, rather, that air pollution is a leveler for all. It's everyone's problem at the equal measure. So before I let you go, I am sure I just have to ask you an answer for this. Will Delhi survive the Diwali pollution this time?
I mean, again, I think it's in the hands of the public. Really, you know, how responsible they end up being, right? You have to realize that, you know, actions have consequences. Well, there has been, I think, a move for this green crackers. You know, this is something that, you know, we've also discussed, you know, in a podcast that we also have incidentally just going to launch sometime in the next couple of weeks. And we discussed the issue of, you know, crackers, and we see that there is such a thing as a green cracker that, you know, that CSIR and NIRI have, for example, brought out. But a lot of the manufacturers in Sivakasi in Tamil Nadu are kind of unaware or out of the loop, right? It seems to be that this is a solution that's available to certain people who have signed NDAs and stuff with CSIR and NIRI, but not to everybody. So I hope those green crackers make their way to Delhi. You know, apparently they're QR coded, you know, and you can actually identify what the emissions level is, and that, you know, they are about 20 to 30% lower in terms of emissions is what we are told, right? Now, 20 to 30% is insignificant given the firecracker load that Delhi will experience, right? It nearly contributes to 60 to 70% of the overall air pollution that you see on the day of Deepavali. So 30% reduction is not really going to help. So given that, you know, this ban and green crackers has been very ambiguous, you know, and typically, you know, something or the other will give way, you know, 10 days before and say, oh no, so many people's jobs depend on it, which it does, not denying it. Right? Nearly 8 lakh people have their employment and opportunities based on the firecracker industry. But that said, it is coming at a phenomenal cost. Now, my sense is that I think this Diwali will still probably be pretty bad. Unfortunately, it is going to come, you know, sort of coincide with the burning period for crop residue as well. So Delhi will certainly have to brace itself, I think, on the, you know, the week of the 26th. But I hope, you know, meteorology, which is ultimately the biggest sort of, you know, trump card, right? It's the joker in the pack. If meteorology works in our favor, then nothing like it, right? It can blow it away. It'll be somebody else's problem, at least for, you know, the period. But that said, it has the it has the biggest potential to make things better for us, at least when we know that nobody else has done their job so far. And that's really what has happened all through September, if you see in Delhi, right? The cleanest September that Delhi has had, I think, in the last 10 years is what it was. And that is courtesy the extended duration of the rains, the prevalent wind direction, right? Which has been, from, I think, easterly for the good part of the last week, right? Which means that, it's from the cleaner areas of UP and Bihar, which has witnessed phenomenal rains, that the winds are blowing. So there's not much to be carried from there. Had it been blowing westerly direction from Punjab, then we would have had, smoke coming in already. But it's catching up. So I think the next 3 days are already going to be bad, at least as far as the forecasts go. And I don't see Deepavali this year being any better than last year itself. But fingers crossed, a lot of things can go our way. And I hope it certainly does.
Well, I will take that as a positive note and hope that it goes our way and we have a better Deepavali compared to the last few years. Karthik, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast and discussing your research and what you plan to do in this space. Air pollution is definitely a major phenomenon, especially in India, major cities in India. And it's good that you came on the show and shared your insights from your work. So thanks again for taking time to be on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Girish. I followed a few episodes in your podcast, which are very interesting as always. And I'm deeply honored that you thought the work that we do is important to showcase. And I really hope that, more people listen to it and understand, the challenges that air pollution really puts forward for all of us as a society. Yeah. Thank you.
And with that, it's a wrap on an insightful conversation. I hope you enjoyed the show. You can find out more about Karthik's research and his work by checking the website of CEW. That is www.cew.in. I would like to hear what you feel about the Mission Chunya podcast. You can leave a rating and write a review on the Apple podcast or any other platform that you tune into. You can also check the website. Yes, the website is up and running, missionchunya.com, to find all the links to subscribe to the podcast, blog, the social media pages, or even drop me a direct message from there. Once again, that is www.missionchunya.com. 2 weeks from now, you'll have another episode, and that one again will be related to air pollution. Want to know more? Subscribe now. So with that, signing off, this is Mission Chunya, towards a zero carbon economy.